Good. Okay, we're moving on. I think the end is in sight, so to speak. It's been quite a long study. The book of Revelation, as we've, I think, realized between us, is quite a detailed book with lots and lots and lots of symbols and so on. And last week, we were most of the way through Revelation chapter 14. So we open our Bibles to that chapter, Revelation chapter 14. We spent some time last week looking at the mark of the beast, you may recollect. And the traditional view, which seems to make a great deal of sense, certainly the one I hold to, is that the mark of the beast has to do with keeping Sundays, Sunday worship. Sunday was the day of worship of the old pagan Roman Empire. It's the mark of that particular beast, the Roman Empire beast. But the Catholic Church made it pretty much obligatory, passed a number of laws, and said if you didn't keep Sundays the way they wanted, you were deemed to be a heretic. And in that sense, you should be deprived of your places of worship, you should not be allowed to buy and sell, and at times you even lost your life if you didn't keep Sundays properly the way they wanted to. So we saw last week that the most likely understanding of the mark of the beast is that it is keeping Sundays. Most of the sort of Bible-believing, left-behind, rapture-type groups out there, of course, can't see that because most of them keep Sundays. And they think that's right. After all, the Lord Jesus was resurrected on Sunday, and therefore Sundays are the day that the church has always kept. So they're rather blind to the true mark of the beast, and they tend to look for other strange things like tattoos or perhaps some type of computer chip implanted under your skin, which do exist and are used. But in a sense of our allegiance, whether we choose to obey the Catholic Church and the beast and accept Sundays and work on Saturdays, or whether we choose to keep God's Sabbaths, plural, the weekly Sabbaths and the holy day Sabbaths, in which case we have the sign of God. I think we saw in Exodus 31 that keeping the Sabbaths is a sign between God and his people. So I think we covered that reasonably well last week. Then we got to chapter 14, and let's pick up the story in verse 6. And we did this last week, so we'll just romp through the next few verses. There were three angels, you may recollect. Verse 6 says, I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, the good news, to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God. And we said last week that this almost certainly takes place in the days or weeks, perhaps even a few months, between the death of the two witnesses, because don't forget, for 3.5 years, the two witnesses have been preaching the gospel to the world. They've been warning the world. The world has hated and detested their warning messages, and when they are killed by the beast, the world rejoices, gives presents, and sings and dances. So for all of that period of time, the truth, the warning, the good news has been preached. But once the two witnesses are killed, and they lie there dead for 3.5 days, then of course the resurrection takes place. There's a brief interlude of days or weeks, perhaps a month, I'm not sure how long it takes, when there is no public work of God. God's saints have all been resurrected. The wrath of God has now arrived. He's about to pour out the vials or the bowls of wrath on this God-forsaking, God-hating world. And in that brief period of time of so many days or weeks, God uses these angels. So these angels are the only voice of truth that the world will hear. There's this first angel, preaches the everlasting gospel, the good news, and says, fear God. For the hour, verse 7, the hour of his judgment has come. And it literally has. The seventh trumpet has blown. The dead saints have been resurrected. Those who are alive have been changed and caught up together into the air. And now God's judgment, his punishment upon this world, has come. Verse 8, and another angel, a second angel, followed, saying, Babylon is fallen, is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. So another angel follows with a message to the world. And quite clearly, I believe, these are messages that are heard. No point God sending angels through the sky shouting messages if nobody hears. So for the people alive at this time, people who have taken the mark of the beast, people in the resurrected Roman Empire, the other nations, China, Russia, they will hear the warnings of these angels. Then verse 9, then a third angel followed, saying with a loud voice, so it's audible, shouting and roaring to the world beneath, if anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or in his hand, picturing your beliefs, your allegiance, your loyalty, and your work, what you do, he himself shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. And so that's three warning messages there from three angels. And verse 11 says, the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. So we said before, it'll be a hard choice for a number of God's people who are not in the place of safety, because if they receive the mark of the beast, they'll be punished by God. If they don't receive the mark of the beast, they'll probably be beheaded. So if you're there at that time, it'll be a rather unpleasant choice you face. And then we go down to, that was it, I think, pretty much, down to verse 14 then, picking up the story now. I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. As clearly as Jesus, and John the Apostle in vision sees Jesus now on this cloud. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. So a picture here being enacted before John of a sickle, you know, sharp sickle being used to reap a harvest, which could be a harvest of wheat or corn, or in this particular case it's more described as a harvest of grapes and so on. So he who sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. So here's a great end time harvest. Is it a good harvest? Then another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar who had power over fire, and he cried with a loud cry to him with the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. So this particular harvest is a harvest described as being a sort of grape harvest. The grapes are fully ripe, and I think it's evident that these are red and purple type of grapes, which are about to be reaped using this very sharp sickle, almost in the sense of a weapon. So the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. So I think we get the picture. We're talking here of God's intervention, described in more detail in the next couple of three chapters. But here in summary version, the people of the earth are gathered together like so many grapes in a wine press. And just as in olden days, I think even today in some parts of the world, you put the grapes into a wine press and you just step into them. And you trample up and down, up and down, up and down. All the grapes, of course, get squashed and squeezed, and all the grape juice pours out and dribbles, and you get running purple and red juice from the grapes. I think it's pretty obvious what that's symbolizing. That's symbolizing blood from human bodies being trampled and squashed and all the rest of it. So we're talking here of a great battle which God's involved in, and the nations of the world gathered together and then trampled to the point where they are killed in huge numbers. And it says here, verse 20, the winepress was trampled outside the city. The city would be almost certainly Jerusalem, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horse's bridle. So what's that, 4 or 5 feet deep, something like that, for 1,600 furlongs, which according to my margin, that's got a little note, says 184 miles. My wife's Bible says 200 miles, but whichever way, it's quite a long distance. And so you've got blood pouring out in rivers and streams for a sort of, a distance of a couple hundred miles. This is a devastating battle. And it's likened here, like it says, to a winepress being trampled. And then, like grape juice, the blood pours absolutely everywhere. So if you keep your place there, and let's turn to a couple of sort of parallel passages. One is back in Joel, or Joel, so back to your Old Testament, the book of Joel, and it'll be chapter 3, which is page 900, if you're using my Bible, let's make it easy for you. So Joel, chapter 3, and there's a couple of passages, at least, that use similar descriptions of a wine press being trampled. It's probably quite graphic in many ways. Joel chapter 3, and we will begin in verse 1. Chapter 3, verse 1. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring back the captives of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there. So God is going to gather and bring together all the nations to this place called the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And there, in that valley, it says God will enter into judgment, which is what we've been reading about there in Revelation, judgment or punishment upon the nations of the world. Dropping down to verse 12. Let the nations be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I, talking of God, I, God, will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. So many, many nations are going to gather, as it happens, are going to gather at Armageddon. We'll come to that, I think, in a little while. And then there's going to be a major battle, the battle of the great day of God Almighty, and it will be at and around this valley of Jehoshaphat. For there, verse 12, I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Verse 13, this looks familiar. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, go down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. A winepress, a harvest, and of course, a winepress is grapes, which when you press them and trample them, you get this purple and red juice. Obviously symbolic of the blood. Verse 14, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. And as at other times, the sun and moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness. It's going to be a very unpleasant day when God intervenes at this stage. So he's going to gather together, like it says here, the nations from around the earth. They're going to gather at the Valley of Jehoshaphat. God will judge them there. And it says, will be verse 14, multitudes, huge crowds, armies in the Valley of Decision, because the day of the Lord is near in the Valley of Decision. As to where is the Valley of Jehoshaphat? Well, there's some debate over that. I suppose it's not absolutely vital that we would know, but the Ambassador College Correspondence Course always said it was the Kidron Valley, which is in Jerusalem, just to the east of the temple, between the sort of Temple Mount. The temple in Jerusalem is on a mount, on a sort of high hill. Then there's a valley to the east of it, and up the side of the valley, the other side is the Mount of Olives. So if you're leaving from the sort of temple area, like where Jesus was many times, you'd walk down into the Kidron Valley, then you walk up the other side of the hill up to the Mount of Olives. I've done that particular walk a few times, and the Kidron Valley is quite a steep valley, and it's believed, although nobody can prove it for sure, it's believed that the Valley of Jehoshaphat is that particular valley. So the fight will take place clearly around the Middle East, but much of the fighting with God will take place around, of course, his city Jerusalem. And so at least in that very sharp valley, there'll be so much blood, it will be up to the horse's sort of bridle, 4, 5, 6 feet deep. Pretty unpleasant. Okay, let's move to Isaiah chapter 63. Isaiah. Chapter 63, another illustration of a wine press and so on. Beginning in verse 1 and reading down to verse 6. So Isaiah 63, and the question is asked here, verse 1. Who is this who comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This one who is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. It's talking of the Lord, the great God. And it turns out to be in this particular case, Jesus Christ at his return, coming from the area of Edom. So I guess that's southeast of Jerusalem. And God answers, I, who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Question asked of him, why is your apparel red? And your garments, like one who treads in the winepress. Why, you expect God to come in pure white garments, pure white clothing, shining and so on. But in this particular illustration, the garments appear to be red, as if God had been treading, it says, in the winepress. So I think we can see where that's going. Verse 3, God answers, I have trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me, for I have trodden them, the peoples, in my anger, and trampled them in my fury. Their blood is sprinkled upon my garments, and I've stained all my robes. So God's talking of a time when he tramples the peoples in his anger. It's the day of God's wrath, which is what Revelation 14 there was on about. And God saying, I've just returned from this battle, I'm stained. Verse 4, for the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. I looked, says God, but there was no one to help, and I wondered that there was no one to uphold. Therefore my own arm brought salvation for me, and my own fury it sustained me. I have trodden down the peoples in my anger, made them drunk in my fury, and brought down their strength to the earth. Nobody wants to be around when God is stirred up in his anger and in his vengeance. And he will bring vengeance upon his people. Remember those in the fifth seal under the altar cry out, how long, O eternal, before we're avenged? And he says, little while longer, and then I will avenge you. This is part of it here. God's avenging his saints, avenging those who've been, killed because they refused to worship the beast or his image or receive the mark and so on. So God intervenes here, and it's you don't want to be up against God. Mm-hmm. Okay, then let's finally look at Zechariah chapter 14, which also appears to describe the same event. Zechariah chapter 14. And we'll begin in verse 1. Behold, of course we have a song around this particular chapter in the Bible hymnal. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I, says God, will gather all nations to battle against Jerusalem. Which is what we've just been reading about. The battle at the Valley of Jehoshaphat, multitudes in the Valley of Decision, at the winepress, being stomped, and juice or blood pouring everywhere. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the city shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Eternal will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. Then dropping down to verse 12. And this shall be the plague with which the Eternal will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem. So these armies, by the millions and millions perhaps, who've gathered early at Armageddon and perhaps now descended down to Jerusalem for that final battle. Of course, God intervenes at one point, and this is what happens. Their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet. Their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets, and their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths. Pretty horrific, and not exactly sure how that would look, but I guess if your flesh dissolves away, then I guess the blood just, gushes, and hence you get blood up to horses in a bridle for 180 odd miles or something. It shall come to pass in that day that a great panic from the Eternal will be among them. Well, absolutely. If you can see your sort of armies all around you just dissolving and just blood gushing around, then great panic. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand, and so there'll be a lot of infighting. Judah also will fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be gathered together, gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance. And so that appears to be talking of the battle of the great day of God Almighty, and pretty interesting days. Okay, back to Revelation. So we had that picture there at the end of chapter 14 of this great winepress of the wrath of God, symbolizing God's intervention and the massive destruction that takes place on all the armies who have surrounded Jerusalem and are going to fight against Jesus Christ at his return. And now chapter 15, fairly short chapter, shouldn't take us very long, really. Verse 1, then, says John, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them the wrath of God is complete, or fulfilled. Remember, we had seven seals. The seventh seal itself was made up of seven trumpets. And the seventh trumpet, when it was blown, it says, now the wrath of God has come. And that seventh trumpet itself comprises seven last plagues, and here they are. So between the trumpet blowing, Jesus taking over the kingdoms of the world, the time to reward the saints, and the wrath now about to be poured out, there's been a gap of a number of days or weeks or whatever length of time it is. The three angels have proclaimed their three last final warning messages, and now the seven angels with the seven last plagues are ready to pour them out. And they complete, bring to conclusion God's wrath. And verse 2, I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire. So I guess perhaps red or orange in color. And those who have the victory over the beast, over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name standing on the sea of glass, having harps of God. Oh, so there are harps. I was rather hoping for bagpipes, but I guess you get what you're given. So this would appear to be, one imagines, the saints, possibly 144,000, but we're leaving a little bit of wriggle room there just in case we get it wrong, but possibly 144,000 standing on this sea of glass, because obviously the resurrection's now taken place. Remember? That was the seventh trumpet blowing. And then there was the three angels with the warning messages, and they were right up to the wrath of God. We're going to get more detail of this winepress being trampled and so on. And here's a picture of the saints standing on this sea of glass, having their musical instruments. And they sing the song of Moses, at least it's not accordions, I suppose that's one good thing. In verse 3, and they sing the song of Moses, the servant of God, and the song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are your works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the saints. Who shall not fear you, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy, for all nations shall come and worship before you, for your judgments have been manifested. So there's a great deal of singing, I guess, going to go on, but here they're singing this particular song about God's great power, His might, His judgment has arrived. And verse 5, after these things I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. And out of the temple came the seven angels, having the seven last plagues, clothed in pure, bright linen, and having their chests girded with golden bands. Then one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God, who lives forever and ever. I think the King James Version says vials, but I think the Greek picture is really a shallow bowl. And each of these seven shallow bowls has got a plague. And these are the final seven plagues that wrap up, complete God's wrath. Verse 8, the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power, and no one was able to enter the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. Seven seals, seven trumpets, seven last plagues. Chapter 16. And we've been through chapter 16 before. You may recollect, if you've been listening in, that the first time through we actually followed the story flow without the interruptions of the inset chapters. So we went from Revelation chapter 6 and the seals, and then we jumped to Revelation chapter 8 and the trumpets, and then we jumped pretty much across here, and we went through the seven seals, then the seven trumpets, and then the seven plagues to get, if you like, the chronological story. Then we've been going back now and filling in the other inset chapters, the 144,000, the true women of God in chapter 12, the beast in chapter 13, and so on. But now we're back up in the story flow. And now, after so many weeks or months, or I'm guessing it's probably days or weeks personally, since Christ returned, I don't think he'd be delaying very much at all. So those three angels may deliver their messages in just a couple, 3 days. I'm not saying it's very long at all, I just don't know. But fairly quickly after Christ's return, he's going to sort things out. And here we go with verse 1. And we'll just read this, I think, through, because we stopped last time to explain and cross-refer certain verses. We no need to do that, I think, twice. So the loud voice from the temple says to the seven angels, go and pour out the bowls or vials of the wrath of God on the earth. So the first went and poured out his bowl upon the earth, and a foul and loathsome sore came upon the men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. So there's definite reasons for not having the mark of the beast. And those who do get this horrible, evil, vile, loathsome, stinking sore, boils and eruptions all over them. Verse 3, then the second angel pours out his bowl on the sea, and it became blood as of a dead man, and every living creature in the sea died. So, and that's goodbye to the sea, it would seem. And of course, the blood of a dead man is not sort of warm and red and runny. A dead man's blood's going to be cold and coagulated, so all pretty horrible. Verse 4, then the third angel poured out his bowl on the rivers and springs of water, and they became blood. So the sea's blood, and all the fresh water's now blood. And I heard the angel of the waters saying, you are righteous, O Lord, the one who is, and who was, and who is to be, because you have judged these things, for they, this evil world, have shed the blood of the saints and prophets, and you've given them blood to drink, for it is their just due. You know, they were happy to shed blood. Well, there's plenty back on you now. And I heard another from the altar saying, even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are your judgments. So sometimes God just gives back to people what they've been busy dishing out. There's plenty of people like to dish out complaints and criticisms and enact violence and take advantage of their power. Well, God passes it right back to them. Verse 8, then the fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and power was given to him to scorch men with fire. And that's going to be, again, well, I mean, there's no water, don't forget by now. It says that the rivers and streams are blood, so there won't be much left to drink, if anything at all. And here the temperature is going to rise to the point of literally scorching heat. And men were scorched with great heat, verse 9. And finally they repented, fell on their knees, and no, of course not. These people at this stage, they seem to be almost beyond redemption. They blasphemed the name of God who has power over these plagues, and they did not repent and give him glory. They are stubborn. Verse 10, then the fifth angel poured out his bowl on the throne of the beast, and his kingdom became full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues because of the pain. Something special about this darkness, but it appears to be limited somewhat geographically to the throne of the beast, and I guess his kingdom, his empire. But the beast doesn't rule the entire world, because the beast largely rules over Europe. And it would seem that Russia and China and Japan and India and other countries may at times ally themselves, may have a trade, but certainly are not ruled or governed by the Catholic-dominated Europe. We'll see that in just a moment. Verse 11, and they blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and did not repent of their deeds. It's hard in a sense to quite understand the stubbornness, but of course for years now they've heard from the great false prophet, who has no doubt really blanketed them with deception. Their minds probably largely brainwashed, and they just cannot see it. They've been perhaps conditioned to believe this is all some invasion from some extraterrestrial rather than the true returning Jesus Christ. Verse 12, then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up. I guess it was red, bloody water, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. And of course, the kings of the east, which we'll take for now to be the Russians and the Chinese and the Asian armies, have been really at war with the European beast power, and they've been waiting to get across, waiting to attack, but held back somewhat by the waters of the Euphrates. But now they are dried up, and now finally the way is made plain and easy, and they're ready to roll. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet. So the beast and the false prophet, the beast obviously is an empire, but pictured in a sense by the man who rules and governs it. The other second beast that we saw before in Revelation 13 is the Catholic empire, but of course pictured and represented by the false prophet, the man who rules it. And they deceive, and it says, for they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Acts of the carrying out God's wishes here. So they're out to bring together the armies, the kings, the presidents, the prime ministers, the rulers of the whole world. And they gather these armies to Palestine, to the Middle East, it says, for the battle of that great day of God Almighty, which of course is where the multitudes in the Valley of Decision come from. God gathers them together through this means, and when they're there, that's the wine press about to be stamped. And verse 15, an interjection, behold, I'm coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. And that would be applying, I guess, to you and me. None of us can afford to sleep. None of us can afford to be casual, to relax, put our feet up, and so on. And some people are. There are a number of the churches of God which are putting off to the far distant future the return of Christ. They're talking about, I've read one that says 2027 is when they think the end of the age is, you know, it's a good 20 years away. And if you believe that, it's going to be quite easy to start to relax and think, oh, we're 20 years away, you know, I've got plenty of time to do what I want, you know, eat, drink and be merry, and in 19 years time I'll start to get my act together. Others are thinking of 2012 and 2017. 2012 is a lot nearer, of course, but even so, it's a few years away yet. Plenty of time to coast, enjoy myself before I start that horrible business of living God's way. Wrong, dangerous, blind. Who says it won't start to erupt this year? It would take almost nothing to catapult the world into the end time events. You know, a couple of three earthquakes in certain locations, a complete collapse of the financial system of this earth could happen by next weekend. Disease epidemics, so the rage across certain parts of the world, could take weeks, a month, 2 months. Foolish to think it's way off in the future and we'll start repenting in the sweet by and by. Verse 16, and they gathered them together, the armies, to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. So we often hear the Battle of Armageddon, and really that's not quite accurate. It's the battle on the great day of God Almighty. And the armies gather together at Armageddon, which is about 50 or 60 miles, something like that, northwest of Jerusalem. It's a great broad plain, nice and flat, stretches for I think about 100 square miles. Plenty of room there for lots of armies to gather. And it looks like they probably descend on Jerusalem, and the main part of the battle probably rages over, you know, many, many miles. But a large part of the battle takes place around Jerusalem, where we believe the Valley of Jehoshaphat is, and so on. And then verse 17, we get to the last of the seven angels. Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, his vial, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, "It is done." I guess that's it finished pretty much now. And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as had not occurred since men were on the earth. That was a little squad diddly earthquake in England this past week, registering a massive 5.2 or 5.3 or something on the Richter scale. And, you know, amazingly, an entire chimney pot fell off, I think, in the town of Grimsby. And a few people, you know, were woken up. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, English time, but it's really nothing. And the USA has had a few much bigger earthquakes than that, and China, some really massive ones in the past, up in the 9-point-somethings. But here's the biggest earthquake of all time. When this final vial is poured out, a mighty and great earthquake, such as has never been before. So that's going to be a big one. And what will that do? It doesn't give detail here, but an earthquake that big, you can just imagine really that most buildings on the earth around sort of the, I don't know how many miles from the epicenter, but I don't know how big the earthquake is for that matter, but let's just say that any buildings within the range are powder and rubble at the end of this earthquake. Verse 19, now the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Then every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. I guess that's part of this great massive earthquake, which might well encircle the whole earth. It could be virtually worldwide. In which case the islands move and shift, the mountains collapse, and great hail from heaven fell upon men, every hailstone about the weight of a talent, which my margin says is 75 pounds. Another nearby Bible apparently says 100 pounds, but either way, whether it's 75 pounds, 100 pounds, if it lands on your head, you're not too interested on the exact weight to the ounce. And it says hailstones, but we said before that these could well be stones, proper stones like meteors hurtling down out of the sky rather than necessarily water, ice, but perhaps they are that. Either way, if they hurtle down to the earth at possibly hundreds of miles an hour and they all weigh about 75 to 100 pounds, there's not much left standing at all at this stage. Trees, buildings, the mountains have collapsed, islands have moved. It's going to be pretty much raising everything down to sort of ground level in preparation, perhaps, for the rebuilding in the world tomorrow. And verse 21 at the end, men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. And really, I haven't got the words to describe, you know, what that looked like. There are probably some quite good creative writers that they could try and turn that into a novel, like the Left Behind series, which is a bit pathetic in places. But really, if you use your imagination, you can think by the time those seven vials or bowls have been poured out, bearing in mind the destruction already from the trumpets and the seals, this earth will be a wrecked place. And man's civilization's finished, kaput, over with. And that brings us almost to the end of the story flow. I think when we first went through, we then jumped a couple of chapters to see the false prophet and the beast individuals being captured and tossed into the lake of fire, and that was where it pretty much comes to an end. But we won't jump there just yet because we have covered that before. So now we're moving on to chapter 17, which is another inset chapter, as was chapters, I think, 12 and 13 and and so on. It's an inside chapter because it goes back now to give us some background to some of the main players at this end time. And then it sort of brings it up to date, right to the end time. So we're starting in verse 1. And this is all about the great harlot and the beast that she rides and has been riding. Historically, but in particular focusing on the end time. So verse 1, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. So the great harlot will have been around for quite some time, but now the angel is going to sort of show, if you like, the final outcome of this great harlot. I'm going to describe the great harlot, bit of background, but then bring it, if you like, from the past right up to the end time and the final days of this great harlot, whoever that might be. And of course, you know, who is the great harlot? It says this great harlot sits on many waters. Well, the many waters are easy enough because we look at verse 15, it tells us what they are. We haven't got to interpret. Verse 15, same chapter, he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So here is a great harlot, the great harlot, the King James says the great whore, and using a more old-fashioned word, but this great harlot or this great whore sits on, or if you like, governs peoples, multitudes, different nations, different languages. So it's an international organization, an international bunch of people who are ruled, guided, governed by this great harlot. And who is the great harlot? Well, I think we know that a woman in Scripture can picture a nation. In the Old Testament, it talks about how, you know, God proposed to and married the nation of Israel. I think we know that. There are a number of prophecies talked about Judah being Israel's sister, which is, of course, a woman. So certainly God's nations are referred to as women, and he was married, you know, to ancient Israel. But in the New Testament, woman, when it's used symbolically, pictures generally a church. Of course, Jesus Christ is going to marry his bride, his wife, and the church of God is the chaste virgin, the woman, the lady to whom Jesus Christ will get married. And so when you look of a a woman in the New Testament that very often, in prophecy at least, symbolically represents a church. So a harlot, therefore it's not too hard to see that a harlot would represent a disgusting church. A church which engages in fornication, a church which is certainly not chaste, and which is immoral, and that's what we're looking at here. So we can try to start add a few clues together. Let's think of a great church, okay? So think of a great church, which is a false church, right? Think of a great false church, which is international in its scope, which sits over peoples and multitudes, lots of people, and nations, and different languages. Think of a great, not just a church, but a great harlot, a great immoral church, international. Verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So think of a great false church, international in scope, which has relationships with kings of the earth, which perhaps receives ambassadors from various nations, which perhaps sends ambassadors to various nations, and which, it says, has made the earth drunk with the wine of her fornication. Drunk with wine, intoxicated them. What would that be? What is the wine that's referred to here? Is this a church of just bottles, you know, plonk? Well, no, because wine scripturally means something a bit different if you hold your place there and turn back to Isaiah 28. Wine is used in the sense of false doctrine, false beliefs that confuse you, that befuddle you, that keep you from seeing the truth. If you're drunk, you can't drive a car safely. If you're drunk, you hardly walk down the street if you're drunk, bumping into lampposts and falling into the gutter and lying there and so on. If you're drunk, you're just not compass mentis. And a false doctrine will have that effect. It will blind you to the truth. You won't see where you're going. It says in a proverb somewhere that the path of the just is as a shining light that shines more and more into the perfect day, but the way of the wicked is as darkness. They know not to what they stumble. Because they're blinded, they stumble. They fall over things, can't see what they're doing. But here in Isaiah 28, I will pick up in verse 7. But they also have erred through wine, and through intoxicating drink are out of the way. This is talking actually of God's people in this particular passage. They've erred, made mistakes through wine and intoxicating drink. And that's come to leave, if you like, the true way. The priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. Well, what's that then? Is it just too much alcohol at the feasts? Well, no, I think you know the answer. It's getting caught up in false doctrine, false teaching, that just blinds you and makes you wander off the path as if you were drunk. You don't go straight any longer, you're stumbling. They are swallowed up by wine, they are out of the way through intoxicating drink, they err in vision, they stumble in judgment. For all tables where they eat are full of vomit and filthiness, so that no place is clean. Pretty disgusting picture, actually. But they've just been supping on garbage. They've been drinking the wine, which is false doctrine, and it's caught them up, and they're blinded to the truth. Looking across at chapter 29, pause and wonder, blind yourselves and be blind. They are drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with intoxicating drink. This is a mental problem, this is a belief problem. For the Eternal has poured out on you the spirit of deep sleep, and has closed your eyes, namely the prophets, and has covered your heads, namely the seers. And so, you know, false doctrine, false teaching, false education, false beliefs make you like a drunk person. And that's what's happened with the Catholic Church. Oops, I've given the game away, haven't I? Back to chapter 17, this great harlot that we've not yet identified, who rules over international peoples, has made the whole world, kings, drunk by what she has taught, by what she has educated, by the deals that she has struck. So think of an organization that has got ambassadors in various countries, and which has often led nations and kings to behave in a certain way. Verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, scarlet red beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And we'll get back to that beast in a minute, but we're still focusing on this woman. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. So, let's think of a great false church, international, which has relationships with many nations, and which is also identified with scarlet and has gold and precious stones, rather wealthy organization, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication, and on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman, this great church, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, says John, I marveled with great amazement. Yeah, he was stunned when he saw this woman, this harlot. And it says here, verse 6, that clearly this particular false church is a persecuting church, isn't she? Because it says that she's drunk with the blood of the saints. She's brought about the death, the blood, the beheading, the burning the stake of the saints of God. The blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So now think of a great false church, international in scope, relations with states, kings and presidents, which hosts them at her headquarters, whom you can associate with red garments and the purple garments, which is a very wealthy organization, and which is associated in verse 5, whose name is Mystery Babylon the Great. I've read the two Babylons by Alexander Hislop, which is almost impossible to read, by the way, but you can sort of dip in here and there. It's a very difficult book, I think, to make one's way through, but it demonstrates that the Catholic Church is modern-day Babylon. The feasts of the Catholic Church, Christmas, Easter, the immortal soul, the Holy Communion, all of these things you can find in ancient Babylon, the cross. The Catholic Church today, its structure, its festivals, maybe teachings, come directly from ancient Babylon. But of course it purports to be the Bride of Christ, and it's a bit of a mystery to many people. Mystery Babylon the Great, and it says it's the mother of harlots. So think of a great church, which we've given the game away, of course, which has got many other churches which came from it, Church of England and many, many others. And as we read, I think last week, you may recollect one Catholic priest writing in a Catholic newspaper said that, you know, the scriptures make it very plain that the Sabbath is Saturday. That's what the Bible teaches. But we, you know, the church of the Catholic Church of Rome, we have changed the sanctity of Saturday to Sunday. And it says the whole world bows in reverence to our decision. And so there are many, many churches which are just spin-offs of the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church is indeed Mystery, Babylon the Great, and is the mother of harlots, other groups and churches. And so it's really not that hard in some ways to identify, you know, who this particular group is. The Trinity is another teaching that Catholic Church, you know, holds very powerfully to, and most Protestant groups, even if you think the Seventh-day Adventists, you might think they're brighter than that. Seventh-day Adventists at least spot the Sabbath and are quite strong at upholding the sanctity of the Sabbath day, but you know, they keep Christmas and Easter, and they believe in the Trinity, so they've accepted much of Mystery Babylon's teachings. Verse 7, but the angel said to me, why did you marvel? You know, John, you seem, you know, so surprised. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. So actually two individuals here, in a sense. There's the great harlot, this false church, this persecuting church that brought about martyrdoms of the saints of God. But this woman, this harlot, is riding a beast, a great scarlet beast, a big red beast, having seven heads and ten horns. And of course, you might think initially, well, hang on, I think I know that beast, don't I? Because if you look back to Revelation chapter 13, you can see here in verse 1, Revelation 13, "Then I stood in the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven horns, seven heads and ten horns. And on his horns, ten crowns, and on his heads, a blasphemous name." So you think, oh, here we are. Here's the beast with seven heads and ten horns, and this woman rides a beast with seven heads and ten horns, so this is the beast she's riding. Makes superficial sense, but actually it's not correct. There are, it's a related beast in Revelation 17, but it's not the same identical beast. So let's have a quick resume of the beast of Revelation 13, and then try and catch the difference between the beast with the same number of heads and horns, which we come across ridden by the woman, because although they're closely related, they aren't actually identical. The beast in Revelation 13, and we've done this in some detail, so this is a quick summary, is the Roman Empire. Okay, the Roman Empire. It has seven heads because it was the final, if you like, amalgamation of ancient Babylon and Persia and Greece and Rome. Remember, Daniel saw Babylon as a lion and Persia as a bear and so on. There was one head for Babylon, there was one head for Persia. Greece had four heads on the leopard, and Rome had one head, so that made seven heads. So when we get to John's vision in Revelation 13, he's looking, if you like, at the combined beast, which was made up of all the previous empires that Daniel had seen, making seven heads. That was the seven heads of that particular beast. The ten horns in Revelation 13 were ten kingdoms to arise out of that particular Roman Empire. So the Roman Empire had the seven heads made up of the previous empires. Ten horns were ten consecutive, not all together at the same time, but ten kingdoms to arise one after another, all the way down to Christ's return. And we saw, and this is again just a reminder, that the Roman Empire, the pagan Roman Empire, was wounded. It had a deadly wound, and it ceased to exist. And that deadly wound was inflicted, we said, in 476 AD, when it fell. Rome fell, according to Wikipedia, which is not a bad place to look for information. That was the fall of Rome. After existing from 31 BC, so that's nearly 500 years, Rome as an empire fell. The fall of Rome was 476 AD. That is a definite date. And according to historians, that's when the Middle Ages begin, 476 AD, at the fall of Rome. It's also sometimes said that's when the Dark Ages began, 476 AD, the Roman Empire, the beast slain. But of course, the beast doesn't stay dead. His deadly wound is healed, and from that, 10 subsequent kingdoms, the horns, come along one by one. The first three were, and we sent a chart out a month or so back, which has got all these details in it. So if you've got that chart, you can always have a little look when you get a chance over the next cup of coffee you have. But the first three horns that arose were the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. And they weren't particularly strong, and the papacy at the time didn't like them because they had the wrong brand of Catholicism. So those three eventually were uprooted because the Pope managed to convince Emperor Justinian to come and boot them out of Rome, which happened in 554 AD. which was the imperial restoration. The empire was restored to Rome in 554 AD. The first three resurrections, the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths, were booted out, written off, and the Holy Roman Empire began in 554 AD when the Emperor Justinian accepted the Pope, if you like, as his mentor, and bowed down and accepted the papacy and the Vatican, if you like, as his ruler. So 554 was the imperial, the empire, restoration. And from then, of course, is now seven, aren't there, left to go. Three horns have gone, the Vandals, Heruli, Ostrogoths. Seven more to go, because there were 10 horns, three down, seven to go. And I'm sure you can, you know, a little test paper now, name the next seven horns, and of course we all know who they are. So the Justinian, that was, if you like, the fourth of the 10 horns. Then there was Charlemagne, the fifth. Otto the Great was the sixth. The Habsburg dynasties were the seventh. Napoleon was the eighth. That's on this chart that you've got. And then Mr. Armstrong says that really the sort of the axis between Mussolini and Adolf Hitler was the ninth, rather weak, resurrection. And of course, there's one more yet to come. So the Revelation 13 beast was the Roman Empire, which was slain, from which 10 successive resurrections occurred. The papacy has ruled over only the last seven. The first three, the Heruli, Vandals, Ostrogoths, didn't submit to the Pope. But since that time, the others have. Six have been and gone. One is to go. So the papacy, the Catholic Church, the harlot, has actually ridden over only seven of the horns. So, when we get back to Revelation 17, and the beast with seven heads and 10 horns, the seven heads here, I hope you're sticking with this, the seven heads here actually are the final seven horns of the Revelation 13 beast. Right? Revelation 13, 10 horns, three pulled up by the Pope, and the last seven resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire are actually influenced by, written by, the harlot. They are the scarlet beast. It's the last seven, and they are the seven heads of this particular beast, because the 10 horns here in Revelation 17, when it says seven heads and 10 horns, the 10 horns here actually coexist together. It's not one after another. These 10 horns are 10 kings who will exist at the same time. So that might sound a bit tricky, but if you look at your chart, and Mr. Armstrong does explain this fairly well in his booklets, so it sort of makes sense if you stop and look at it, and it will become a bit clearer as we carry on in any event. So we got as far as verse 7. The angel says to John, "Why did you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman, the Catholic Church, the beast that carries her, which is the healed Roman Empire and its seven resurrections." See, the woman, the harlot, never rode the first three horns in Revelation 13. She has only ever influenced the healed Roman Empire from 554 AD. That's all she's ever influenced. So that's the seven heads that she rides over, and the 10 horns. Verse 8, "The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition." The bottomless pit, we said before, Mr. Armstrong's explanation, is a sort of condition of impotence. It's a really, you know, it's out of sight. But then, from time to time, it comes out of this bottomless pit or abyss. And here it says, ultimately, this beast, still talking of the healed Holy Roman Empire, will ultimately go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel when they see it, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not, and yet is. And really, you know, you and I, in a sense, shouldn't be desperately surprised when we see the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, the one of these heads that is yet to come. Seven heads and ten horns. The seventh head isn't here yet. It's still awaited. But it says here that the world will marvel when this beast comes out one more time from the condition of impotence, this bottomless pit. It says all who dwell on the earth will marvel. They'll be astonished and think, wow, look at that. And they're going to sort of step back in amazement. You and I should step back, all right, but not quite in amazement. But oops, it's here now. Verse 9. Here is the mind which has wisdom, here's what is wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Seven heads are seven mountains. What's a mountain in prophecy? A kingdom, a government. Seven mountains on which the woman sits. And if you think of mountains, the mountains tend to have a top and a bottom. You have the summit at the top, maybe a few thousand feet up, and then it goes all the way down to sort of ground level. I think of these seven mountains. These are the seven resurrections of this Holy Roman Empire. And I guess if you look back at history, you'll see long stretches where it's flat. So between one mountain and the next, where really nothing was significant about the Holy Roman Empire, almost ceased to exist. Then gradually it sort of climbs out up to a peak, perhaps some very powerful king or emperor. Then perhaps he dies and squabbles in the family, and it sort of tails away and slides all the way back down to nothing. Then there's a long stretch of flat ground before the next mountain starts to climb up. And that's the way it's been. These seven mountains on which the woman sits are the seven resurrections, the seven governments, seven kingdoms that have been since the days of the restoration in 554. Actually, of course, one is yet to come. Some people say that, well, you know, Rome is built on seven hills, and that's what it means. Well, it's interesting that Rome is built on seven hills, but these are actually, it says in Greek, seven mountains rather than seven hills. And looking at Wikipedia, that's a place you find everything out, it turns out that according to Wikipedia there's about 25 cities on the earth which are built on seven hills. So it's not just an identification of Rome in that sense. Moscow apparently is built on seven hills. Worcester, Massachusetts is built on seven hills. Edinburgh, Scotland, claims to be built on seven hills. I suspect that's not exactly true. Lisbon in Portugal is built on seven hills. But here, verse 9, it says the seven heads are seven mountains which woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must continue a short time. So these are the seven resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire from when the Pope started running it and governing it, writing it. Five have been and gone already, one is, and the other has not yet come. And you think, well, hang on a second, there has to be a particular time when that is true. If you're at the head of the time, none of the seven have arisen. If they come too late in the day, all seven have been and gone. But here it says five have fallen, one actually is in existence, and one is yet to come. Mr. Armstrong says that's when the prophecy was revealed. It was back in the 1930s, 1940s, that Mr. Armstrong came to understand the book of Revelation. And at that stage, of course, five of the resurrections had indeed been and gone. One actually was there in front of his eyes, Mussolini, Hitler, and one had yet to come. And it says when this final one comes, he must continue a short time, which is perhaps 3 to 4 to 5 years. Verse 11, and the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. Which is a slightly enigmatic sort of verse, that. But in a sense, you have the seven resurrections, and then of course the pagan empire before that, I guess, makes up the eight. Verse 12, and the ten horns which you saw are 10 kings who receive no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So unlike the Revelation 13, which had 7 heads and 10 horns, one after another, after another, after another, down through almost 1500 years, this particular scarlet beast in Revelation 17 has the 7 heads, being the 7 final resurrections. The 10 horns relate to the final head, and it says here there are 10 kings, or 10 presidents, or 10 leaders, who have received no kingdom as yet, and they still haven't to this day, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So these rulers are going to be around for a very brief time, maybe just a year, 18 months, not very long at all. And so somewhere between now and Jesus' return, we're going to see this final seventh head of the Holy Roman Empire resurrect. We're going to see 10 other countries, 10 kings, 10 presidents, 10 prime ministers, 10 rulers of some sort, going to combine forces with this beast power for a very brief period of time, months, maybe a year. Verse 13, they, these 10, are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. The Amplified says they have one common policy. These are allies of the beast. So this final European empire, this probably German leader, is going to have allies, and these 10 presidents, prime ministers or kings, whatever they are going to give their power, their armies, their authority to the beast. Verse 14, these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So we can see here these are 10 kings who exist at the same time, not one after another. These 10 exist right up to the return of Jesus Christ, because it says, verse 14, they make war with the Lamb. When Jesus is returning, these 10 kings, along with the beast, attempt to fight the returning Jesus Christ. And of course, big surprise, he overcomes them. So these 10 are yet to arrive, and when they do, it won't be very long at all. Verse 15, and he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot. They'll hate the church. I mean, perhaps for a while, they'll go along with the false prophet and his promises and predictions and his charismatic approach as he tries to deceive more and more people. But of course, it'll be a very much a love-hate relationship. These presidents, these kings, these prime ministers, and the beast will actually eventually turn on the Catholic Church. It says, the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, hate this false church, hate the false prophet, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. They're going to retaliate at some point towards the very end against this church, which will obviously have failed to deliver. I guess the false prophet's going to make all these promises about, you know, I can put all these people behind you and I can bring peace on the earth and all the rest of it. Of course, as God intervenes and things go from bad to worse, they'll finally come to despise the church and its hypocrisy and its cant and its wealth and turn on it. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind, and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. And of course, Rome is a great city. And in terms of the Catholic Church, people often sort of in brief talk of Rome, as they're saying, you know, all roads lead to Rome. Doesn't mean if you go out for your shopping tonight, you'll end up somewhere near the Vatican. But all roads lead to Rome, and basically the Roman Catholic Church, the church at Rome, it's a very powerful institution. People talk of Washington. They don't mean the town of Washington, they mean the power that resides there. You know, Washington says this, Washington's going to do that. London says this, London's responding as follows. Rome is a great city, and Rome pictures the power of the Catholic Church. And of course it says here, these 10 leaders, these 10 rulers will turn against the church eventually and destroy it. Nothing quite like people falling out when they're carnal and so on. Okay, brethren, I guess there we pretty much concluded our Bible study for today. That's chapter 17 done, so making very good progress. So we'll leave it there for now, and if we can just